Good afternoon, and welcome to the recording of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier. It's Friday, February 19th, and I'm your reader, Bob Young. The forecast is for a mostly sunny day. It's going to be cold, with a high of only 18 degrees. Winds are from the southwest between 4 and 8 miles per hour. Tonight it will go down to 2 degrees and be partly cloudy, with winds easterly from 3 to 6 miles per hour. Saturday it warms up, with a high Saturday of 24 degrees and a low of 20. And that warm-up continues through the next week. Looking around the region, mostly sunny and cold today, partly cloudy and frigid tonight. Frostbite to exposed skin within 15 minutes. Partly sunny and cold tomorrow. Sunday, snow much of the time. Snow accumulation will be between 3 and 6 inches. Looking at the front page, we have Waterloo details bias cases. Bottle bill faces new challenge. Waverly Utilities steps up for Texas. And Democrats proposing 8-year path to citizenship. We begin with Waterloo details bias cases. Wright's panel looked at 1,086 complaints over a 10-year period. Stories filed by Sydney Sizon. Waterloo. The Waterloo Human Rights Commission examined 1,086 cases of possible discrimination and closed 838 cases from 2010 to 2019, according to a new report. African American residents filed 71% of the complaints to the commission during that time frame. Waterloo has 16.7% Black or African American residents, according to U.S. Census data. Women filed nearly 59% of the commission's complaints, while U.S. Census data shows women make up 49.9% of Waterloo's population. Of the 1,011 cases where people reported sex, 596 were female and 415 were male. Of the 800 cases where people reported race, 568 were African American. The main discriminatory action people complained about from 2010 to 2019 was wrongful discharge, the report said. That was followed by general harassment, unequal treatment or service, unequal discipline, and promotion or demotion. The vast majority of complaints were made against employers, the report said. Complaints consisted of 944 in employment, 121 in public accommodation, 11 in education, and 1 in housing. More than 60% of complaints were made against private corporations. More than 14% of complaints were made against healthcare systems, and nearly 11% against retail stores, the report shows. Complaints of discrimination in public accommodation can include people being followed in stores, accused of shoplifting, or treated poorly when getting served at restaurants, Johnson said. People can file complaints of alleged discrimination based on one or more protected characteristics outlined in state and federal law. Race was cited most often in 36.5% of complaints, the report shows. Physical disability was cited in about 13.6% of complaints, and sex was cited in 13.4% of complaints. Rebecca Johnson, city human rights specialist, works with the Reverend Abraham Funchess, Human Rights Director, to remove barriers that cause racial discrimination. Quote, I don't want to say that Waterloo is a racist community because there's so many more positives than negatives in our community. But I would also not be truthful if I didn't say we have more work to do, Johnson said. People who identify as female can file discrimination complaints under more protected characteristics. Johnson said women generally face more instances of sexual harassment than people who identify as male, and women can face unfair treatment during pregnancy. The race and sex data are based on people who reported that information to the commission. It is not required for people to disclose, Johnson said, which makes the numbers not completely reflective of all the cases handled by the commission. The commission is expected to close 50 to 70 cases per year by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, Johnson said. She said the commission met the threshold set by EEOC, which is based on federal fiscal years. The commission did not close that many cases in calendar years 2010 and 2013, according to the report. The commission opened 92 cases in 2018 and closed 72. In 2019, the commission opened 57 cases and closed 71. Johnson said the commission aims to close cases within 18 months, but some last longer. She reviews complaint forms and determined which cases warrant investigation under civil rights law. The Human Rights Commission can hire a third-party professional to hold mediation meetings between parties. If Johnson finds probable cause that discrimination occurred, the parties can have conciliation meetings. The commission helped victims get nearly $1.6 million in economic relief from 2010 to 2019, according to the report. This included more than $985,000 from conciliation meetings and more than $674,000 from mediation meetings. Johnson said the data include an estimated six-figure settlement in 2018 from private court proceedings. More than $1.2 million of the settlements were in 2018, the report shows. Johnson said one of the largest cases involved a woman who alleged discrimination during her pregnancy. The report said eight cases from 2010 to 2019 ended with successful conciliation. Another two cases ended with probable cause and no conciliation, which Johnson said happened when she could not get in contact with the people who filed the complaints. Another 66 cases could have had probable cause, Johnson said, but people who complained either withdrew from the process or found lawyers to help them. There were 571 cases that were closed, transferred to another agency, or did not have probable cause, the report said. Successful mediation happened in 21 cases. There were 200 cases filed for discrimination on the basis of physical disability. Johnson said the discrimination against people with disabilities often involves employers who fail to properly accommodate workers. She said some companies do not have conversations with employees to learn how to help them. Some workers recently filed discrimination complaints for disability because they got COVID-19 and alleged unfair treatment by their employers, Johnson said. This includes people who were told they would be fired for quarantining and others who were told not to come back to work after doctors cleared them. Johnson said the most rewarding part of her job is educating people and employers on why certain policies are discriminatory. Quote, "That's the reason I get up every morning," said Johnson, who has more than two decades' experience. Quote, "That's the reason I've been doing this as long as I have," unquote. Waverly Utilities steps up for Texas. Waverly Utilities are called upon to supplement power to the South, filed by Kristen Guess. And it begins with a photograph of people lined up, each of them bringing along with them a propane tank, and they have blankets over their heads because they're standing in freezing rain for over an hour, the caption says. Waverly, parts of the country experiencing power outages after a deadly blast of winter, have called upon some Midwest utilities for help. Waverly Utilities self-generated electricity for 24 hours from Tuesday to Wednesday to aid southern states experiencing rolling blackouts caused by the extreme cold weather conditions. Quote, "With our self-generating ability, as long as fuel is available, we can isolate the community from the grid reliability issues that we witnessed happened in the southern states," said WU CEO Daryl Wenzel. Waverly Utilities maintains 36 megawatts of dual fuel, diesel and natural gas generators, enough electricity to power the city of Waverly. Utilities from Minnesota to Texas, including some in Iowa, implemented rolling blackouts to ease the burden on strained power grids. Southwest Power Pool, a group of utilities covering 14 states from the Dakotas to the Texas Panhandle, said rolling blackouts are no longer needed, but it asked customers to conserve energy until at least 10 p.m. on Saturday. Cedar Falls Utilities and American Energy this week asked customers to limit energy consumption as much as possible through Friday at least. Power has been restored to all but 500,000 homes and businesses in Texas, down from about 3 million a day earlier. But utility officials warned limited rolling blackouts could still occur, and many are still without power or safe drinking water after winter storms ravaged the state's utilities and overwhelmed the electrical grid this week, leaving millions shivering in the cold. The storms also left more than 320,000 homes and businesses without power in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. About 70,000 power outages persisted after an ice storm in eastern Kentucky, while nearly 67,000 were without electricity in West Virginia. Because frigid conditions are uncommon in the southern states, their infrastructure was not built to withstand below freezing temperatures, causing natural gas wells to freeze. As electric production plunged, demand soared to heat homes and businesses. This shortage was exacerbated by lower than anticipated renewable electricity being produced due to similar failures caused by extreme cold, according to a release from Waverly Utilities. As some parts of Texas began to slowly warm up, others dealt with another round of snowfall on Thursday. Del Rio, located along the U.S.-Mexico border in southwestern part of the state, had received nearly 10 inches of snow on Thursday, surpassing the city's record for snowfall in one day, according to the National Weather Service. And snow was still falling. Officials in Del Rio asked residents to conserve electricity or risk having the local system lose power. About 150 miles east of Del Rio, residents in San Antonio also dealt with snowfall and frigid temperatures. Forecasters called for up to 3 inches of snow in the city. Snow and ice moved to the Appalachians, northern Maryland, and southern Pennsylvania, and later the Northeast. Back-to-back storms left 15 inches of snow in Little Rock, Arkansas, tying a 1918 record, the National Weather Service said. The extreme weather was blamed for the deaths of over 36 people, some while trying to keep warm. In the Houston area, one family died from carbon monoxide as their car idled in their garage. A woman and her 3 children were killed in a fire that authorities said might have been caused by a fireplace they were using. Bottled bill faces new challenge. Story filed by Rob Bossart, Des Moines. A Senate subcommittee on Thursday advanced a bill that would allow grocery and convenience stores to opt out of accepting empty beverage containers that are now covered by Iowa's 1978 bottle deposit law. Under Senate File 368, retailers could refuse to accept all nickel deposit containers effective July 1, 2022, if an authorized redemption center were within 20 miles of their business. People would have to take their empty cans and containers to those centers to reclaim their nickel deposit, as is the case at many stores now because of COVID-19 restrictions. Quote, the bill very intentionally makes simple but fundamental improvements in our current process, said Senator Ken Rosenboom, Republican of Oskaloosa, the bill's sponsor who chaired a Senate Natural Resources and Environmental Subcommittee that advanced the measure by a 2-to-1 margin. Rosenboom said beer and liquor distributors now keep all the bottle deposit fees that are not redeemed, which has grown, quote, into a very large sum of money, unquote. He said the proposed legislation would have those deposits turned over to the State Department of Revenue, where the Alcoholic Beverage Division would distribute the money. No details were given about where the money would go. Lobbyists Bill Dix, representing Fairway Stores, and Brad Epperly with the Iowa Grocery Industry Association spoke in favor of the proposed changes, with Epperly saying grocers, quote, are not in the waste collection business, unquote, and urging lawmakers to end the, quote, government-imposed mandate. However, Urbandale resident Jane Robinette said requiring consumers to make up to a 40-mile round trip to a redemption center to recycle their cans and bottles, quote, raises so many obstacles, I just don't think that it's workable, unquote. She called for a more balanced approach that would raise the bottle and can deposit to 10 cents and cover more containers not now included under the law. Others worried Iowa would return to litter-strewn road ditches that preceded the Iowa Spottle Bill. Jess Mazur of the Sierra Club's Iowa chapter echoed Robinette's call to expand provisions of the law and double the handling fee to 2 cents for redemption centers. He told subcommittee members that the deposit law is, quote, wildly popular with Iowans, but some grocery stores and retailers are trying to use COVID-19 concerns as an excuse for not accepting can and bottles they've sold, as the law requires. Quote, we don't believe this is something that the grocery stores actually want because of COVID, she said. They've been trying to repeal and gut the bottle bill for a long time, and if it really were about COVID, they would also not allow people to take their dry cleaning there or rent rug doctors from the grocery store. Quote, so I think it's just taking advantage of a really horrible situation to continue to gut Iowa's bottle deposit law, unquote. Rosenboom challenged the premise the bill would gut Iowa's law, telling Mazur, quote, I don't think that's a fair assessment, given the bill is intended to allow various players time to build infrastructure and business models under the new provisions. After 9 years of seeing efforts to modernize the bottle bill fail, Rosenboom said he wanted to tweak the current law without ending it. He predicted provisions of the bill would lead to more business for redemption centers. Quote, I think sometimes we get too cute by half, and our attempts to modernize this program die of 1,000 cuts. We've all seen it happen, unquote. The Oskaloosa Republican told those attending via the subcommittee meeting via Zoom. Democrats proposing an 8-year path to citizenship. This story is filed by Alexandra Jaff of the Associated Press. Washington. After decades of failed attempts to pass comprehensive immigration legislation, congressional Democrats and President Joe Biden are signaling openness to a piece-by-piece approach. They unveiled a bill on Thursday that would provide an 8-year pathway to citizenship for 11 million people living in the country without legal status. There are other provisions, too, but the Democrats are not talking all or nothing. Quote, even though I support full comprehensive immigration reform, I'm ready to move on piecemeal because I don't want to end up with good intentions on my hands and not having anything, unquote, said Texas Representative Henry Cuellar. Quote, I'd rather have progress, unquote. The pragmatic approach is a clear recognition of the past failures to deliver on a large-scale immigration overhaul, and how success could be even more difficult in a highly polarized, closely divided Congress. The Democrats' legislation reflects the broad priorities for immigration changes that Biden laid out on his first day in office, including an increase in visas, more money to process asylum applications, new technology at the southern border, and funding for economic development in Latin American countries. But advocates for expansive immigration say they could pursue smaller bills focused on citizenship for groups such as young immigrants brought to the U.S. by their parents as children, for agricultural workers, and other essential labor. Quote, I know what it's like to lose on big bills and small bills. The fear that people have experienced in the last 4 years deserves every single opportunity, every single bill to remedy, said Grisa Martinez Rosas, executive director for United We Dream, an immigration advocacy group. The biggest thing here is that we're going to get something across the finish line because not doing so is not an option, unquote. The broad legislation, which includes a pathway to citizenship, but not much in the way of enhanced border security that's typically required to win Republican votes, faces long odds with the Democrats holding only a slender majority in Congress. Even before the new bill was unveiled, Democrats were reining in expectations for their final result. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Dick Durbin has said that any final Senate bill will likely not reach the same levels as Biden's proposals. Indeed, comprehensive bills negotiated by bipartisan teams of lawmakers failed multiple times during Republican George W. Bush's administration and again in 2013 during Democrat Barack Obama's. Republican Donald Trump signed legislation that increased border security and took executive action to restrict legal immigration to the U.S. and remove some protections for immigrants living in the country set by Obama. Biden has signed a number of executive orders rolling back some of the Trump restrictions, but he promised throughout his campaign and transition that an immigration overhaul would be a top priority. The White House insisted Thursday that there have been no decisions on strategy, but multiple immigration organizations said administration officials had signaled in recent conversations that they were open to a multi-level approach in which lawmakers would press forward on the comprehensive bill while also pursuing individual pieces. Cuellar, who was in office for most of those early failed attempts, said many in Congressional Hispanic Caucus are still committed to a comprehensive overhaul. He said the White House reached out to him, and he advised them to start with a broad bill, but he added that, quote, reality is going to hit people, hopefully, unquote, and more lawmakers will get on board with a more incremental approach. Indeed, Biden himself in a CNN town hall Tuesday night that, quote, there's things I would deal with by itself, unquote. One of the lead sponsors of the bill, New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez, too, seemed to suggest Thursday he was open to a less expansive approach. Quote, if we can get certain elements of this standing up and passed individually, both in the House and the Senate, that's great, he said. Tom Jowitz, Vice President for Immigration Policy at the Center for American Progress, said that Biden's decades of experience in the Senate have given him a realistic view of what's possible. Quote, he also knows how to count votes, and he knows what it takes to get legislation across the line, he said. Quote, and so I think there is real energy behind pressing forward on all fronts and seeing what shakes out, unquote. Democrats have a third option, using a parliamentary maneuver to attach some immigration items to a budget bill, which would then require just 51 votes to pass. Advocates have been pressing the new administration to consider attaching a pathway to citizenship, for some, to an economic stimulus package that they're expected to introduce after they've passed the COVID-19 bill. That approach would almost certainly face a strong procedural challenge. Quote, the ultimate goal is to make sure that 2022 doesn't come around and we have done nothing on immigration for another Congress, said Jowitz. Democrats have expressed optimism that this time will be different, not just because of the shift in strategy, but also because they say the politics of the issue have changed. They point to support from business groups for reform, and they note that Latinos are not a monolithic Democratic voting bloc, that Trump improved his showing with Latino voters in the 2020 election. Let's turn the page now to the Cedar Valley section. The kindness of strangers. Shedd Aquarium gifts special day to Denver pair battling cancer. Story filed by Kristen Guess and begins with a photograph of the outside of the John G. Shedd Aquarium building and also a picture of the couple, Denver. It's true, news travels fast. Just 3 weeks ago on January 25th, the Courier featured a local couple who both were diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. Dawn Gwynn was diagnosed with metastatic cancer in her ribs, spine, skull, and liver in April, and her husband Bob was diagnosed with terminal advanced metastatic stomach cancer in December. Since then, the Gwynn's phone has been ringing off the hook. The Denver couple has received complimentary tickets to their bucket list destination, the opportunity to reconnect with Bob's former U.S. Navy shipmate, and more than $10,000 in donation. They also will join a live podcast for an inspirational discussion on living with cancer. Quote, it's been really overwhelming. Just complete strangers willing to help you out in your time of need, Dawn said. Quote, it's really restoring our faith in humanity, Bob said. The Gwynns had noted visiting the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago was on their bucket list when the Courier interviewed them last month. Public relations specialists at the aquarium got wind of their story and offered free tickets and a VIP experience based on the Gwyn's interest, which include penguins, sharks, and the Great Lakes exhibit. Quote, "We will likely walk around the aquarium galleries before going behind the scenes for a few special moments just for them," said Cole Sellers, Shedd's assistant director of guest relations. Quote, "We are touched that Shedd Aquarium was able to bring joy and hope as they were experiencing challenges in their lives," Sellers said. The Gwyn story also will be aired at 9 p.m. March 5th in a podcast with Jose Morledad Zimmon, host of On the Air with FACC, unquote. Zimmon, who was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2018, is the president and founder of the Filipino-American Cancer Care, a nonprofit cancer support organization in Washington, D.C. She also is a journalist and White House correspondent for organizations in the Philippines. Dawn said she is hoping to bring awareness to both breast and stomach cancers. She also wants to relate to others how they are helping each other through their challenges as husband and wife. Quote, "We have never really heard of another couple facing stage four together," she said. Long-lost friends also have seen the news, including Danny Lakin, Bob's former shipmate from his days in the U.S. Navy. "They haven't seen each other in 20 years. When Shedd Aquarium reached out to us, I connected with Danny to see about catching up," Bob said. Bob and Lakin were hospital corpsmen stationed at the Great Lakes in Illinois together during Bob's service from 1989 to 1992. Bob also was stationed on the USS Alamo in San Diego and served 6 months overseas with tours to the Philippines, Thailand, Korea, Hong Kong, and Hawaii. Bob and Lakin will reconnect in Chicago this spring when they visit the aquarium. The Gwyns credit the generous donations they've received with helping pay medical bills. After the article ran, the couple received $2,800 via a GoFundMe online fundraiser launched by their good friend Jacob Spiegel. The total has now topped $10,000. Quote, "It's really taken a weight off of us. We're keeping up with all medical payments, and that's a blessing to be able to do that," unquote. A former co-worker and his wife, who share the Gwyn's love of the Waterloo Blackhawks hockey team, gave them $600. A Denver couple mailed a $1,000 check. A Waverly nurse dropped off a gift basket with treats for the Gwyn's cat, Sasha. Bob has received an additional $650 from his employer, Fastenal. Quote, "From a $10 donation to a $1,000 donation, we are so grateful," Don said. With Bob's job being their only source of income, the donations also help pay for utilities, rent, medical supplies and equipment, and medications. Just one of Don's medications costs $2,500 per month. Quote, "I'm going to keep trying to work as long as possible," Bob said. "It's starting to get rough, but I'll do it as long as I can." Family members also are showing their support and giving the Gwyns plenty to look forward to. A son is getting married February 27th. A daughter recently got engaged. Another daughter, who is serving in the U.S. Air Force, is expecting the Gwyns' first grandchild and will be moving closer to Iowa. Quote, "We are grateful for everyone reaching out to us, sending cards, sending checks, calling to check on us. It is greatly appreciated," Don said. For more information or to donate, email bobgwin007@gmail.com. Send mail to 221 Donna Street, Apartment 1, Denver, 50622, or go to the GoFundMe website. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Friday, February 19th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Nicholas J. "Nick" Miller, 67, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, February 16th, at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center. He was born December 7, 1953, in Hampton, son of Arnold and Leona Bedard Miller. He married Christine L. Palmer, July 27, 1974, in the United Methodist Church at Mount Auburn, Nick graduated from LaPorte City High School in 1972 and attended UNI, where he was a member of the wrestling team. He was employed with John Deere for 39 years as an electrician, retiring in August of 2012. Massive Christian burial will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, February 22nd, at St. Edward Catholic Church, with burial in Westview Cemetery, LaPorte City. The Mass will be live-streamed at 10:30 via www.sted.org. Public visitation will be from 4 until 7 p.m. Sunday, February 21st, at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway, where there will be a 6:30 p.m. vigil service. Face coverings and social distancing is required when attending these events. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. Brandon. Marlene M. Brown, 84, of Brandon, Iowa, died on Tuesday, February 16, 2021, at the Journey Care Center in Barrington, Illinois, surrounded by her family. Marlene was born to Orville C. and Charlotte M., maiden name Davis, layman, on May 13, 1936, in their home in rural Brandon, Iowa. Marlene attended a Brandon community school and graduated in 1954. She went on to attend the Iowa Teachers College in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and received her certificate of teaching in 1956. On November 29, 1957, she married her high school sweetheart, Larry D. Brown, at the United Methodist Church in Brandon. Larry joined the U.S. Army, and they lived throughout the United States. Marlene really enjoyed her time in Alaska, California, and Manhattan, Kansas. In 1978, they settled on a farm they purchased in rural Brandon, Iowa. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, February 20th, at the United Methodist Church in Brandon, Iowa, with Reverend Luke Evans presiding. Burial will be held at the Brandon Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. until 8 p.m. on Friday, February 19, 2021, at the Rife Family Center in Independence, Iowa. To leave an online condolence, please go to www.rifefamilycenter.com under obituaries. Chris Gersema, 93, of New Hartford, passed away on Wednesday, February 17, 2021, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home in Waterloo, Iowa. Chris Elmer Gersema was born on December 1, 1927, the son of George and Senna, maiden name Reince Gersema, at home in rural Shell Rock. On January 13, 1950, he was united in marriage to Viola Vi Davis in Clarksville, Iowa. Chris worked for Farmers Co-op, driving a feed truck, until retiring in 1990. He attended First Baptist Church in New Hartford. Chris was a member of the New Hartford Lions and the Iowa Odd Fellows. He enjoyed going to auctions, collecting tractors and iron, claiming he was known as the Iron Man. Funeral service will be held on Saturday, February 20th, 2021, at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly. Visitation will be held on Saturday from 1 o'clock p.m. until the time of service. Private family burial will be in Cedar Valley Memorial Gardens in Cedar Falls. Memorials may be directed to either Liberty Baptist Church Mission Fund or to Cedar Valley Hospice, and online condolences for Chris can be left at www.kaisercorson.com. Kaiser Corson Funeral Home of Waverly is assisting the Gersema family with arrangements, and their phone number is 319-352-1187. Stephen Patrick Loftus, 52, of Waterloo, died Thursday, February 18th, at the Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. Visitation will be from 12 o'clock to 4 o'clock p.m. Sunday, February 21st, at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on South Street, phone number 234-6274, where there will be a 3 p.m. prayer service. Memorials may be directed to the family. Condolences may be left with www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. Uni Domes fabric roof to be replaced. story filed by Andrew Wind, and begins with an aerial photograph of the complex of the McLeod Center, the Unidome, and the Wellness Recreation Center. There's a dotted circle and a red star on the very peak of the Unidome fabric cover, which indicates the area to be replaced. Cedar Falls. The University of Northern Iowa is looking at replacing a central section of the Unidome roof 2 decades after it was installed. Estimated to cost $7 million to $8 million, the project received permission to move forward with planning this week from the Iowa Board of Regents Property and Facilities Committee. Regents are expected to approve it Wednesday as part of the consent agenda when they meet virtually starting at 10:30 a.m. Quote, "It's just the fabric portion, the center portion of the roof." Michael Hager, UNI's Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations, told the committee. The other part of the roof is PVC, a synthetic plastic polymer, which was installed in 2010. The remainder of the roof is still under warranty until 2040. The fabric, which accounts for 25% of the surface, was found to be deteriorating in December 2019 by a consultant UNI hired. Minor repairs were done last year, but it needs to be completely replaced by 2024. Quote, "That fabric was last replaced in 1999, and it lasted 23 years, Hager said, after the Unidome opened in 1976. "This particular fabric we're moving into year 22, so we're approaching the end of the useful life." The board documents say a better fabric will replace the current material. In addition, maintenance would be performed on the support structure. More safety lines and anchor points would be installed, and roofs over the main entrances would be updated. Money to pay for the improvements could come from several sources. Those include gifts, the Fieldhouse Fund, the General Fund, and the Athletic Department. Quote, "We haven't finalized the source of funding yet," said Hager. Quote, "The next step would be to hire a design professional for the project," unquote. Prior to installation of the current fabric roof in 1999, the Unidome had a full-size air-supported fabric roof system, the first for an indoor stadium in the U.S. At that point, the outer portion of the roof was converted to metal. That was later damaged by hail and replaced with the current white PVC in 2010. More information about the meeting can be found online at iowaregents.edu. Man pleads guilty to reduced charges in Waterloo opioid death case, filed by Jeff Reinitz. Waterloo. A Waterloo man accused of selling fentanyl-laced heroin to a man who died of an overdose has pleaded guilty to reduced charges. Marcus Anthony Sally, 39, opted to take a plea deal offered by prosecutors Thursday morning, a day after testimony began, in a trial where he faced manslaughter and drug distribution charges. Under the plea agreement, Sally admitted to selling drugs to 49-year-old Adam Sharkley on February 14, 2017, but the state dismissed charges related to Sharkley's death the following day. Sally also admitted to selling a fentanyl and heroin mixture to a confidential informant working with the Tri-County Drug Enforcement Task Force several times in February and March 2017, following the overdose death. Sally pleaded to 4 counts of delivery of heroin and fentanyl with sentencing enhancements because of prior felony convictions. Prosecutors dropped the manslaughter charge, and the drug sentences will run concurrently for a total of up to 15 years with a 3-year mandatory minimum. Following the plea, Joel Jerriemple told Sally he faced significant prison time if he had been found guilty at trial. Quote, "This is a wise decision on your part," Dalrymple said. Quote, "If you were convicted, this would have been a drop in the bucket to what you were facing." Prosecutors said Sharkley was released from Waterloo Work Release Facility on February 13, 2017, after serving prison time. He moved into a house at 216 Cortland Street, and around 2 p.m. February 14, 2017, he bought the heroin. The following day, at about 7 a.m., friends, and a roommate called 911 after finding him dead on the couch. An autopsy and toxicology test found methamphetamine and potentially lethal levels of heroin and fentanyl in his system, according to testimony. And now the Call the Courier column. Question: will the UNI football game on Friday night be on TV? Answer: the game against South Dakota State is scheduled to air on Panthers Sports Network, CFU Channel 15, KCRG, NBC Chicago, and ESPN 3. Question: when do the students at Hawkeye offer dental work through their clinic? Answer: according to the clinic's website, there are times on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays between August and May that appointments can be scheduled for hygiene care. Appointments can be scheduled Wednesdays and Fridays from January to May for dental checkups. Contact the clinic at area code 319-296-1030 to schedule an appointment. Question: why wasn't the new Cedar Falls swimming pool included in the original cost of the bid? Answer: it was intended to be a later phase of construction on the new high school that would partially rely on sources of funding outside of Cedar Falls Community Schools. Those include City of Cedar Falls dollars and donations gathered through a fundraising campaign. The district now hopes to complete the pool facility when the rest of the school is completed by the fall of 2024. Question: what is tuition at UNI for students that are taking a full course load? Annual tuition at the University of Northern Iowa is currently $7,665 for a full-time student. In addition, students pay fees as well as room and board if they live on campus or have a meal plan. Question: why is the Blackhawk County Health Department refusing to vaccinate teachers when other counties are doing so? Answer: teachers in Blackhawk County are being vaccinated, according to health department and school district officials. The county waited until it got enough COVID-19 vaccine doses from the state before vaccinating teachers. K-12 teachers were listed after first responders to get vaccinated in the next recommended priority group. Question: so many people working at the Burger King in downtown Waterloo had their masks pulled under their noses. Is the health department checking out local eateries? Answer: Blackhawk County Health Department Director Nafisa Sissy Iboigne said people can notify her department if they have concerns about local food establishments not following COVID-19 guidelines. She said health department officials will visit businesses to educate them about safety measures. Question: why is it that people under the age of 60 working from home that are employed by Mercy One are being administered the COVID vaccine before those that are at high risk? Answer: Nafisa Sissy Iboigne, Blackhawk County Health Department Director, said she follows up with health care systems to ensure people getting vaccinated fall into the state's recommended priority groups. She said Mercy One always provided logical explanations for anyone who got the COVID-19 vaccine. Question: how are Unity Point, Mercy One, and People's Clinic going to prioritize those 65 and older who are to get the vaccine? Answer: Blackhawk County Health Department Director Nafisa Sissy Iboigne said the healthcare systems generated lists that randomly prioritize people 65 and older. There will be no priority given to people who meet other criteria. Calls for this column are taken on a special courier phone line at 234-3566. Questions are answered by courier staff and staff at the Waterloo Public Library. In Metro Briefs, CBE announces new hires, promotion, Cedar Falls. Brian Hoekstra has joined CBE as a software developer too. He was previously a senior hardware software engineer at Gross Chop Incorporated. Maya Justice has been promoted as a trainer 1 at CBE. She was previously a PPA team captain. Terry Schmock has been promoted to manager of product services and development department. She was previously a technical project manager. Grout fundraiser has Irish flavor, Waterloo. Friends of the Grout Historic House will hold its annual St. Patrick's fundraiser from noon to 6 p.m. March 20th at Jameson's, 310 East 4th Street. The $15 registration fee includes a Reuben sandwich with fries, a goodie bag containing a free pass to the museum, and more. Proceeds go to the maintenance of the Rensselaer Russell House Museum and the Snowden House. Register by calling 234-6357. Present your receipt printed or on your phone to receive your to-go meal and goodie bag. Museums for All program planned. Waterloo. The Grout Museum and the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum have announced a new access program for low-income families. Through Museums for All, those on food assistance can receive $2 admission to the Grout Museum District simply by presenting their EBT card. This is to encourage people of all backgrounds to visit museums regularly and build lifelong museum-going habits. Women's Group has 5 scholarships. Cedar Falls. The Cedar Falls Business and Professional Women's Organization is accepting applications for 5 scholarships to students who live in the Cedar Valley and plan to attend an area college. The Mary Robinson Memorial Fund will give 2 $1,000 scholarships to non-traditional undergraduate nursing students, and CFBPW will provide 3 $1,000 scholarships to non-traditional undergraduate students. Grants will be issued based on financial need and merit. Get an application at the financial offices of the University of Northern Iowa, Wartburg College, Allen College, Hawkeye Community College, and Upper Iowa University, and UNICUE. The deadline is March 31st. Union High wins state honors. Hudson. The Union High School Fine Arts Department has again achieved the highest honors possible with Iowa High School Speech Association. All 3 Union Musical Theater entries have been named All-State honorees. The 3 groups are How to Succeed in Musical Theater Without Really Trying, with performers Sunshine Gray, Audrey Klein, Sophie Winkelpleck, Grace Johnson, Kyla Neuendorf, and Joe Bistline. Chicago, with performers Laura Rempe, Cora Klein, Carly Spohr, Sybil Tim, Sarah Roberts, and Jacob Hill. And Scrubs, with performers Tyson Flesher, Ellie Hookham, Madeline Rath, Rebecca Dickerson, Matt Carlson, and Hayden Spohr. The groups were under the direction of Tim J. Mitchell and Corina Carlson. 3 alumni of the program were also named All-State at their prospective schools. Casey Tecklenburg at Hudson, Jess Larrison at Grundy Center, and Austin Pauling at Western Dubuque. Iowa GOP moves quickly on bill limiting early voting. Stories filed by David Pitt of the Associated Press. Des Moines. House and Senate committees on Thursday approved a bill that would significantly limit voting by mail and early voting, threaten criminal charges against county auditors who depart from state election guidance, and remove voters from the active voter rolls if they miss 1 general election. The quick action, with only Republican votes, makes the similar House and Senate versions of the bill eligible for floor debate as early as next week. The House is planning a public hearing on the measure at 5 p.m. on Monday. The far-reaching bill would cut the mail and in-person early voting period from 29 to 18 days, after Republicans whittled it down from 40 days just 4 years ago. It would bar counties from mailing absentee ballot applications to voters, tightly regulate how absentee ballots can be returned, and potentially reduce many early voting locations. Democratic Senator Pam Jochim argued during committee debate that the bill did nothing to protect elections or encourage voting. Quote, "It is an attack on Iowa's democracy, and it is disgusting," Jochim said. During a House committee debate, Republican Representative Bob Kaufman defended the bill, saying it ensures successful elections, election integrity, and the right to vote. Quote, "I adamantly ardently and judiciously believe that HSB 213 does not suppress one single vote, he said. Republicans in 33 states have introduced or carried over 165 bills this year that could restrict voting access, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, a Washington-based public policy institute. Many Republicans have said the new bills are meant to shore up public confidence after President Donald Trump and his GOP allies, without evidence, characterized the election as fraudulent. Those claims were turned away by dozens of courts and were made even as a group of election officials deemed the 2020 presidential election the, quote, the most secure in American history, unquote. The Iowa State Association of County Auditors, which represents elections commissioners in all 99 counties, warned the bill would remove local decision-making, threaten severe penalties against election workers who make mistakes, and increase their staffing needs and workloads. Voters would see longer lines at polling places on Election Day and at the remaining early voting sites, said Ryan Doctor, a Republican who is the group's president and auditor in Sioux County. The bill is also opposed by disability rights groups, the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa, AARP, the League of Women Voters of Iowa, and labor unions. Republicans have the votes to pass the bill without Democratic support, and Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signaled Wednesday that she was open to reducing mail and early voting opportunities, calling the current 29-day window, quote, a long period of time, unquote. Parton asks Tennessee not to put her statue at the Capitol. Stories filed by the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of Dolly Parton performing while holding a white guitar. Nashville, Tennessee. Dolly Parton is asking Tennessee lawmakers to withdraw a bill that would erect a statue of her on the Capitol grounds in Nashville. Quote, given all that is going on in the world, I don't think putting me on a pedestal is appropriate at this time, Parton said in a statement issued Thursday. Democratic Representative John Mark Windle introduced the bill last month that aims to honor Parton, quote, for all that she has contributed to the state, unquote. Aside from her status as a music icon, Parton is a lifelong philanthropist. She founded the Imagination Library, which mails books to children under the age of 5 across the world to improve child literacy, and her $1 million donation to Vanderbilt University helped develop the highly effective Moderna coronavirus vaccine. Her advocacy for racial justice was recently celebrated in a mural at Nashville. In advocating for the statue, Wendell said, quote, at this point in history, is there a better example, not just in America, but in the world, of a leader that is a kind, decent, passionate human being? She's a passionate person who loves everyone, and everyone loves her, unquote. In her Thursday statement, Parton thanked the legislature for their consideration of the bill and said she was honored and humbled by their intentions. Although she asked lawmakers to withdraw the bill for now, Parton said, quote, I hope, though, that somewhere down the road, several years from now, or perhaps after I'm gone, if you feel I deserve it, then I'm certain I will stand proud in our great state capital as a grateful Tennessean. In sports, Go Hawks advance 8-2, sit in second, filed by Jim Nelson, and begins with a photograph with the caption, Waterloo West's Caden Carnes drives Ankeny's J.J. Mahan to the mat during their Class 3A 113-pound first-round match on Thursday. Carnes advanced with an 11-0 major decision. Des Moines. Waverly Shell Rock head coach Eric Whitcomb had no idea where his team stood. To be honest, Whitcomb wasn't concerned about it either. After a 2.5-hour bout-by-bout, position-by-position slugfest, the two-time defending 3A state champions find themselves in what certainly will be a 15-round boxing match in attempt to three-peat. The Gohawks advanced 10 of its 12 qualifiers to day two, including 8 into the quarterfinals. Waverly Shellrock trails Waukee by 4 points in the team standings after Thursday's first round at Wells Fargo Arena in the traditional Iowa State Wrestling Championships. Quote, "There is no doubt this is going to be a war here," Whitcomb said. Quote, "I have no idea where we are at, but I like where we are sitting with our guys. This is all that matters at this point," unquote. Waukee also advanced 10-9 to the quarterfinals. Southeast Polk, Iowa City West, Fort Dodge, and Bettendorf remained in the battle. WSR got pins from Bailey Roybal at 120 and McCray Haggerty at 182. Ryder Block, 132, Aiden Riggins, 152, and Jake Walker, 195, all produced technical falls for the Gohawks. Quote, "My goal for this tournament was to come in and dominate everyone," Karn said. "I don't want to settle for scoring a couple of times or winning by a couple of points. I really want to go out and dominate. I don't want anyone to be able to keep it close, so I focused on that to make sure nobody gets that chance." Two of Cedar Falls' three qualifiers advanced to Friday, including Dylan Witt at 138. Witt scrambled out of some second-period trouble against Fort Madison's Gavin Weissman before hitting what he calls the Mark Hall roll for a pin in 5 minutes and 28 seconds. Quote, "Obviously, I didn't wrestle as good as I could have," Witt said. "That doesn't mean I still can't win the whole thing. I let him get that bar in a little too tight, and he got two out of it. But I knew once we got back to our feet, there were no worries. He was sloppy, so I took advantage of it," unquote. After losing his first round match in the closing seconds, Riley Bennett regrouped to pin Matt Surlis Davis of Fort Dodge to remain alive at 170. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Friday, February 19th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time, and you may wish to stay tuned for the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.